Go loud. Dishing It Out with Gary O'Hanlon and Gareth Mullins. A Go Loud original podcast.
Your ultimate culinary companion.
Go Loud. Sounds better with us.
Okay, welcome to another episode of Dishing It Out with me, Gary O'Hanlon.
And me, Gareth Mullins.
And coming up on today's program, we will have our technique of the week, as always, our culinary conundrums. And we have one of the best chefs in the country, Ed Cooney, executive chef, Gareth's old boss.
He's my boss a couple of times, and he's also a very, very good friend of mine. So I'm delighted that he came in. So
I know Ed. I go back a good bit with him myself. Ed Cooney from the Marion Hotel, one of the most prestigious guests in Ireland, coming in. Don't go anywhere.
Okay, so it's our technique of the week, and this week it's blanching. Quite a chefy word, Gary. And I'm going to do a very quick synopsis of what it is, and then maybe you give us a little recipe around it. So blanching is really where you take something and you drop it into, if it's vegetables, it's going to be into hot boiling salted water. And then you're going to do another little technique behind that called to refresh. So if you're blanching broccoli, for example, you'd have a pot of boiling salted water. You'd drop your broccoli in. It'd cook for 2 or 3 minutes, 2 minutes probably. And then you take and plunge it into a nice cold bowl of water. Now I mean a bowl of water with ice in it. And that technique is called refreshing. And what you're trying to do is stop the cooking. So when we're talking about blanching, it's normally a technique where you're getting something ready and then you're going to have it there for service. And why are we telling you about this as a home listener? So maybe you're having a dinner party or you're having friends over. You would blanch your green veg before everybody gets there, and then you just bring it back to life in a pan with some, maybe back into some boiling water again for a second, then into a pot with a little bit of butter or some olive oil. Or another way to do it is you might be blanching fish for fish and chips, for example. So when you're standing in the chipper and you see all that stuff that's all already done, that's in a batter. So what that technique is called when they put it into a batter and then into the fryer and then take it back out again, that's called blanching. So Gary, I think that's kind of a blanching to a...
Yeah, and you've probably the two or three things that obviously every single green veg, and you absolutely must blanch green veg. If you want the chlorophyll to pop out and you really want it to look lovely and green on the plate, it is absolutely essential. It doesn't matter if you're a trained chef or just a basic home cook. You cannot cook green veg at its optimum from start to finish in one cook. You must go through the blanch and refresh process. So if you're wondering why your peas or your broccoli or your sugar snaps aren't as green as they are in the K-Club or the Marker Hotel, it's because you're maybe not doing that technique. And one of the other big ones is probably chips. So one of the few things that nearly every household at some point has given a rattle at is chips. Chips are another thing that really must. You'll often see the triple cooked chip, which, for example, would be like a Morris Piper, best potato you could use. You cut them up, parboil them, let them dry, and then 130 degree oil, cook them in the first cook low, and then 170 degree oil is the crisp process. So suppose those two, green veg fries and the fish and chip, is another great one. Probably the best examples that of things that must go through a blanching process or a pre-cooking process before you actually eat them. And that's us for this week on that. Okay, so it's time for our interview of the week. And this is a guy who's been executive chef of probably the most iconic hotel in this country anyway. Ed Cooney, it's great to have you on Dishing It Out. How are you?
I'm great. Bit sore today.
First things first. You got to tell us a story about when you fired Gareth and got rid of him and sent him down the road to the Marker.
Twice he fired me. Oh,
yeah. It was, I don't know, he came to work with us. You were young.
Yeah, 98 or 99, the hotel was open about a year.
Right, yeah.
And I'll always remember Aldrin Lucy interviewed me.
Did he?
Yeah. Right. And I wore a short and tie, and I remember.
I thought you were going to say a Liverpool jersey.
No, my brother, I was made. My father worked in the hotel industry, so Grillman is which really played well for me because Grillman is quite high up on Ed's.
Yeah,
but and I remember my brother dropped me off. He says, "You like something going out of Blade and Westlife?" You know? And I walked into the Marion. I didn't meet Ed on that interview, but I met him very shortly after that. But another very good friend of ours, Aldrin O.C.
I know that name, yeah.
Audie's another exec chef.
Yeah.
He's down in the Rose.
Rose and Tralee.
So, Ed, I know what, how many years now?
27,
yeah. And executive chef all that time, or did you go up the ladder?
No, I opened it as exec chef.
Wow.
Come back from London.
You would have been young.
I was 32.
Yeah.
Giving away my age now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Still very young for a job that prestigious.
Fair point. When I look back at it, actually, I was. I didn't think it at the time, truthfully. I was executive sous chef in the Regent Four Seasons in London for 2.5 years before that, and which is now the Landmark Hotel in London. But so I felt I was ready.
Yeah.
Now, coming back to Ireland wasn't on my agenda, quite frankly. I'd been away for 14 years, going on 15, and I was very happy working for Four Seasons, and I kind of saw my
good group
career
staying there.
Travel with him, become a bit of a Four Seasons boy.
Yeah.
That was kind of in my head. But then the approach came for the Merion. And I'll be honest with you, Gary, I didn't have much maths on the Irish hotel scene. You know, at the time, there wasn't much going on.
Yeah.
The K-Club was around.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, yeah. It was the cream of the crop back then.
Yeah, it had gotten very tired.
Yeah.
Because I remember Terry was up in the Intercom at that time. Was it in the comments?
Terry White.
Yeah.
No, that came after.
Oh, was it?
Oh, no, we didn't have anything. Like, the Four Seasons hadn't opened, which is now the Intercon.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, you had the Shelbourne, you had the Conrad, and that was about it.
Yeah.
And in Dublin, anyway, you know. Mm. Yeah, you had decent...
London would have been... I mean, even back then, it was probably knocking on the door of Paris, New York, as culinary capital of the world.
Yeah.
I mean, like, if you're cutting it at executive sous level and... level Four Seasons over there, then you were, and you're obviously the owners of the Merion. Then had they familiarity with you, like were they guests, or how did they come on you?
I tell you, I got headhunted, and then I got a call to meet Peter McCann. Mm-hmm. I didn't have a clue who Peter McCann was, right? But he was the general manager of the Merion, and Peter was obviously the first appointment made by the owners, and he was bringing a team together, and so I met, the first time I met Peter was in Heathrow Airport, and it was in January. I remember it well because I was living out in just beyond High Wycombe, and it was handy for me to get to, I was on holidays actually, yeah. And I said to him, listen, I'm actually on holidays right now. And he says, where are you living? I told him, anyway, we kind of met in the middle. He says, I'm in and out of Heathrow all the time. I can come and meet you there. So we met in the bar, in terminal, whatever it was, where you could get the flight to London or Dublin to London.
And
that was the first time we met. And the brief I was given is that he's a big, tall guy. You'll see him, you'll know him when he walks in the room.
It's a good description.
It is.
Yeah. Yeah.
I was like, this is so Irish. Because I'd been out about it for so long, right? It was like taking me back. And I was like, all right, okay, cool. And this is back in the day now, before any social media. So
or mobiles.
I came with my portfolio, right? With all my food photographs and menus. And I was well prepared, right?
Yeah.
Well groomed. And I struck it off with Peter straight away. And so... what kind of, you know, you have a feeling, you get a feeling, right? You know, it's an instinctive thing, you know, your
gut. Of course.
And obviously, you know, looking at an executive chef's job, your relationship with the general manager is absolutely crucial.
Oh, of course. Right?
It's not going to work if you can't build a relationship. And so I could see that happening. And then the next course of events was Peter invited me over to come to see the Merion. Now, the Merion was still a building site at this stage. And I'll never forget it, right? He was showing me around, we were going around Dublin, and then we had lunch in the Clarence, the tea rooms in the Clarence, and Michael Martin was cooking there, right? It was one of the hot places in Dublin at the time, right? So we sat down, we're having lunch, and then the interview started. The real interview started, right? That's when Peter kicked in, and I was like,
over.
Oh, yeah, yeah, exactly, right? I remember this, right? And I was like, all right, okay, here we go, all right, let's go. Cool. But what convinced me in the end, right, to take the position was the caliber of the people that Peter was recruiting in the other key positions, like sales and marketing, like the resident manager, accountancy. All of these people they were all of a similar generation to me. We'd all emigrated. We'd all gone to work overseas, New York and London and whatever, but we were all working at a very high level.
Yeah.
And probably glad to get the opportunity to come home, but we were ambitious and we wanted to create something that wasn't in Dublin.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, over the years we've achieved that.
But you hit the nail on the head there, because I mean, I know, look, I've only recently gone to the K Club too, like, but it's, you know, you think, like, people think, oh, somebody like that or a big hotel comes in a few and you jump at it, it goes, no, there's no way. You want to meet the people at the top of the ladder, a two or three. In fact, it was over a good few months for me anyways. And look, Gareth and I have been close for a long time. And I know, obviously, the relationship with GMs and that as well. With you, I mean, when you're in the cold face off it, like, you need to be able to go at it, but ultimately be able to gel and push a business forward, because it is, it's full on. And how many rooms are in the Merion? Like, give listeners a bit of an idea of what business there. Like, where does, is it the travel and tourist? It's not really conference and banqueting for you. Like, is it mainly day-to-day bedrooms and everyday dining guests, right?
142 bedrooms. Now, for me, for my part of the food and beverage operation, I got a garden room, restaurant, to sell a bar, 24-hour room service, private dining function rooms, and 24-hour room service. And then, but please remember as well that we have restaurant Patrick Ebo in the Merion.
Yeah.
And it's a very important part of the Merion Hotel.
Yeah.
And it was also an important consideration for me taking the job as well, because a lot of guys would look at that going, do I want to be in that place? You know, they had one star at the time, and you know, am I going to be like kind of in the shadow and so on?
Yes.
I that was never an issue for me, to be quite honest with you. And because I was used to working with that structure in London, right? The London five stars were beginning to go that way, and having a chef in the, you know, the fine dining restaurant, bringing the stars.
Was Gables there from the get-go?
Yeah, 100%. Remember, the owners, Mr. Quinn and Mr. Nocton, are also part owners of Gables. So that was always going.
So that was part of the plan. That was all
part of the plan. Yes, 100%. And I, you know, they do, like, obviously I've gotten to know them very well, and Guillaume LeBrun was so helpful to me.
Yeah.
When, because I was out of the country for 14 years, I didn't know any suppliers.
Oh, you were that way that long?
Yeah. Wow. He really helped me, like, finding suppliers and quality, and everybody he uses, of course, is quality. So
yeah,
I'll be forever grateful to him. And he let me use the kitchen to do the first photo shoots for the Merion, because I was on my own. I was the only chef. I, you know, they were down in Baggot Street in the old Gibos, and he gave me a call out of the kitchen. He was really helpful, you know. And
he's a gentleman, Gibo.
Yeah.
He's
he's such a, you know, okay, he's kind of semi-retired now, you know, and whatnot. But like, the man has had a Michelin star for like 30 odd years.
Yes.
Two stars now. And I don't know. No, he keeps a low profile. He's never sought the limelight. Sometimes think he's never been given the credit.
Kind of right there, because I know everybody nearly associates it. Maybe it's because we're Irish or whatever. I know I've got a fondness for Kieran with the Longford connection.
Kieran came along.
But Kieran came along after. Like, he's definitely the slightly more, and even at that, it's only slightly more public persona or public profile. Like,
Kieran's a low profile guy.
Yeah,
as
he's
well,
still,
you know,
quite low profile himself, isn't he? Like, I mean, they are Jesus, machines of the industry, those boys, aren't they? Like, just,
I always remember you'd have to run up to Gibo's to get something or talk about something, whatever. And you go upstairs, and Guillaume would be in the wash-up, and he'd be washing and putting dishes through. Yeah. And he'd be like, I'd come back down and say to him, Guillaume's up in the wash-up there. He goes, yeah, he likes doing that. But like, I don't think people listening would understand that people that do air job, I mean, there's all different.
He probably
sets
finds
to the
it
job.
Therapeutic. Yeah, but the other thing, in there.
Exactly.
He makes the bread. And pastel forever.
Brilliant baker.
Incredible. Yeah. I mean, I'd literally go into Gibo's just to eat the bread.
Yeah. I think they say
I love the bread.
You can always make the bread in his gaff as well back in the day. You know,
really?
Yeah. Even when, you know, whenever we got older or whatever, like, it was one of the last stations he gave up. Was
the funny you mentioned his name. I took out one of his books last week, because I'm doing a few French classics for the, you know, the Olympics are starting in Paris, and I'm doing a few I took out a couple of his books. Yeah. You know, he's proper classic French music.
Big time.
But he's,
I don't know what has me going down a rabbit hole of him and Nico Ladenas over the last wee while, you know what I mean? But it's, you're seeing some of this, and it kind of brings you back to the college days, really, because it's the last time you would, you know, one or two episodes ago, we were talking, you know, Blanquette Daniel and Blanquette de Vaux and all of these kind of things that we would have Irish to you, basically, only sounds better.
I remember a story. As part of my travels around the UK, I was a head chef in a restaurant in Glasgow. I have a Glasgow connection, right? But I went to Glasgow straight after college to work. Anyway, it was called the Triangle, and they have the Roux Brothers Scholarship. And one of my chefs got to the final of the Roux Brothers Scholarship, won the Scottish Heat and all that kind of stuff, right? And it was a girl called Paula. And so the final was down in the Four Seasons in London. And the classic dish, they got two
Yeah, that's
there was
the
two aspects of it. One was a mystery basket and one was a classic dish. And the classic dish was blanquette de foie.
No way.
Right? Paula had to do that. But anyway, here's, and there's another story. Gary Rhodes was down there, God rest him, right? And with the spiky hair, one of his kids was in the final. And he was like, he poached Paula off of it.
No way.
Oh, I swear to God, right? I was like, and I had all these books. He was kind of like a bit of a hero of mine, right? You know, I've all these cookery books and I used to really, you know, admire the guy. And I was like, you can't do that. It's just...
Gary Rhodes is the reason I've had bad hairdos since I was 13 or 14. I absolutely adored Gary Rhodes.
Oh, he was a rock star, wasn't he?
Well, Gary Rhodes and Floyd were on TV when there was nobody on TV.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Floyd for just his demeanor and the way he...
He was
just
the,
so relaxed on
they
TV.
They call him the first celebrity chef.
Oh, yeah. He was incredible. You know what I mean? And but I thought Gary Rhodes was a very... He's a Tom Cruise of acting. He was very underappreciated.
But he was a good chef. He was I still use some of his recipes.
Yeah.
You know, because they're good recipes. They work, like, you know. And
the time he opened here in Ireland, every chef I knew was fucking delighted whenever he failed. It used to really, really grind.
The location was wrong for that restaurant.
It probably was, yeah, and it was a bit big too, you know what I mean? But everybody seemed to jump on it. I thought, Jesus Christ, like, I mean, the guy was a brilliant chef.
Isn't that our best pastime, begrudgery?
Well,
as a nation, we're very good at it.
I think the three of us are maybe out on our own there, but there's a lot of paddies that fucking love to see people feel. It's an awful trait of the Irish.
It's desperate. I was having, after a few pints last night, right, with the lads I was with, we were having a row in Donny and Nesbitt's about begrudgery.
Yeah.
And Rory McIlroy and you two. I don't understand the Irish begrudgery against these two.
Two of the greatest exports.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Right. To me, they're like amazing. But no, people love to kind of tear strips off them and bring them down. I don't understand.
I thought you were going to say this fucker was sending me text messages for getting beaten in the All-Ireland final.
Oh, do you know what he sent me? Do you know the first text he sent me last night was battered? Question mark.
How did he beat by a point or two?
Exactly. I won't tell you what I said. Give a bit of a backstory here.
Every game with Dublin play in, whether it's even if they're warming up and they're friendly, if they're beating, he's all over me like a rash. So
yeah. There's a reason for that, right? Like I'm a gam. No, I'm a big sports fan, full stop, right?
Yeah.
But Gaz, my kind of first love. But to me, he's the worst kind of Gaz supporter, right? He's the guy that doesn't go to a match one end of the year to the next, but he always gets a ticket for the All-Ireland final.
Yeah.
What can I say? I know people.
I know. I'm already jealous.
Yeah. And he rang me last week looking for a ticket, so you know.
But 2012, Donegal always playing me in the final. Whenever somebody recognized me in the crowd, goes, oh, I haven't seen you at any games all year. And I goes, I only go to finals.
No.
Don't be annoying me.
Oh,
but that's the only thing you can say to somebody that's getting fucking all hot and bothered is really twist the knife in them.
And Ed, you know, much has changed, do you think, in your role in the... Because I know we often talk about this type of thing on and off. But
yeah.
Like our jobs haven't changed, but certainly our approach had to change.
Yes.
So what do you attribute that to, or what do you think?
What do I attribute it to?
20 odd years ago, like, what did your working week look like and what does it look like now?
When I look back on it, I go, that was awful. What was I thinking?
Doing too much?
Yeah. You know. 60, 70 hour weeks. I had a young family, like four young kids, and like it was work and home, and that was it. There was nothing in between. And that's actually when I started running, actually, 20 years ago. But anyway, that's by the by. It was a very unhealthy thing.
But all kitchens were like that, right?
Oh, yeah, it was just unusual, but that's the way it was. That's the way our industry was.
Yeah.
And there was one thing I said to Garrett when he asked, If I'd want to come on and have a chat with you lads, was like, there was one thing I wanted to talk about, and that was the industry conditions, how we need to make the industry more attractive to young people than it is, and why, understand why it's not, and do something about it. Because, like, you know, the three of us here are all exec chefs, right? You know, we're in fairly influential positions, and things have improved beyond all recognition, but it's no longer a question of like me looking at what Garrett is doing there and what you're doing at the K Club or what Gary Hughes is doing at the Shelburne, what kind of conditions they've got and so on. We're competing against like the LinkedIns of this world and, you know, Gary Anderson, Gather and Gather, and like, because they're employing an enormous amount of people and the conditions that they provide, which is great.
Yeah.
We need to get that.
Yeah.
And there's no more of this, like, low-balling wages, low-balling conditions, and just, no. I can say this now because I'm closer to the end of my career than I am to the beginning, and so I can probably speak a little bit more frankly about it. And I do so. But I'd feel very passionate about that. Mm. We got to do something about the industry. We got to get young talent coming into the industry. Like we were chatting about the number of chefs. I have 44, 45 chefs on the team now. And like I counted them. I have 7 Irish chefs.
Yeah.
Right. And like 4 of us have been working in the Merion for 15 years.
Wow.
So there's no kids coming through.
No.
Do you even interview anymore? Or not? That's never.
They're not there. Well, it's like the quality of the CVs are not there.
I'm nearly glad to hear that because like when I started in the K Club 4 months ago, like we had him. I got him out of college when I was in Viewmount House, and then I brought him to the Chateau in France. And when I was going to the K Club, I was like, look, you know, hopefully there's a position here. Like, because this kid he's phenomenal, and I want to bring him with me. And you know, Paul and Monica, the people I were dealing with at the time, were delighted. And one of them turned around and said, you know, it's about 2.5 years since we had an Irish CV in there. You've just brought 2 right away. And then a Scotch guy that worked for Marco for 16 years. And he worked for me for a few years. I put him in as a head chef in one of the restaurants too. I mean, he's Scotch, but again, it's we've had to go way, way beyond. You know, when I look across 40-something chefs as well, you know, they're from all over the world and quite brilliant at what they do. But again, in saying that, eventually they might want to go home or go whatever. Yeah. Like, and where's the next wave coming in Ireland, you know?
Well, Gary, what happened to me was, like, COVID came, the team was stripped. We started back with about 15 chefs in the team and gradually built it up again. But it became very apparent that, like, you know, trying to rebuild it and looking at CVs, because there was nothing coming in. The only CVs coming in were from non-Europeans, people from outside the European Union. And we made a very, the Merion, the organization, made a conscious decision to, we're going to have to recruit from outside, which means work visas, which means more expense, means a much elongated recruitment process.
Yes.
But I can be honest with you now, and I got 22 people working in the kitchen, right, who are on the 2-year work visas. Quite frankly, if we didn't have them, we'd be half the business we are. And but the other aspect of that, they've all worked in the Middle East and so on, because I honed in on like their backgrounds. Like they're all got 5-star
hotels, Dubai hotels,
Dubai, Doha, whatever it may be, right? Ritz Carlton's, Four Seasons, etc. So they come in and they just fit in seamless.
Yeah. And the general skill set is similar.
Skill set,
better. Yeah.
Honestly, better. And like, because there's no more spoofers. They're not spoofing. I'm a chef de party. I can do this. Like, I can do that. And I've worked in a pizzeria down in Temple Bar.
Yeah.
Once. Do you know what I mean? I want 34,000.
And what the listener is there, just what Ed is talking about there is that like a chef de party is basically someone that's qualified.
Yeah.
They're a tradesperson, if you like, if you're rather than still an apprentice.
And a manager station. Yeah. Not there. I mean, there's a lot of guys with me have come from the exact same, like, you know, the Ritz Carlton, Dubai, all the 5-stars and beyond over there. But they're Rolls Royce cooks.
Yes.
They really, really are. They really remind me a lot of the guys, like, if you ever cooked in America, without the South American workforce, the American economy would just grind to a halt.
Well, the hospitality industry would end.
Well, the hospitality industry would be absolutely decimated. And by the way, most hospitals as well.
Yeah.
If you want to really think about it.
It's funny because
it was working in the States.
In Boston. Boston.
It's funny because the Eurotalk Young Chef competition, we see a lot of young Irish candidates still. And I don't know whether that's because of how we market it or.
Yeah, it is. But what you're getting there is the cream.
Yeah, no,
creme
de
la creme. Yeah,
sure.
You know, and they're working in.
I mean, this year there was 44, I think, we interviewed. Yeah. So, and then out of that, I mean, they're not all Irish, obviously, but there's a good handful. There's 15, maybe.
But it was only recently I did an interview and it made me remember there was 1,500 or 1,600 applications for the chef course at Tourism College Killybegs the year I went in 95. And there was 100 spots. After 4 weeks, they get rid of 10. So you're left. It's called the October Talks. And the best 90 are kept on. That was what we were told day one. 10 will be dropped after 4 weeks.
And I was talking to the head of college a year or two ago, and there was eight applications.
That's the reality.
Frightening.
Yeah.
You know?
Like, I used to do a lot of work with CERT down through the years, years ago, trying to get people interested in just the hospitality industry, you know, when once they've finished doing their leaving certificate. And I guess it's a question that the country is much more affluent, much wealthier. There's way more opportunity in all sorts of industries for the kids coming out of school and colleges these days. So, like, you know, if hospitality is going to be serious about attracting talent, then we have to be serious about the terms and conditions that we...
But the conversation and the mantra for so long was nearly you wore it like pride if you worked for five splits a week and you wore it. But
I've done all that.
Yeah.
I was that.
And I mean, we were the people, people doing our jobs were out saying that, oh, if you work 60 hours a week, then you're a real chef. If you decide to go into corporate catering, then you're not a real chef. You know, that's not what real chef is.
I know.
About.
Monkey see, monkey do, though. You know.
Yeah, but I mean,
if you're not up in that environment, then that's all you knew. That's all any of us.
But look, I do think the conversation is changing, thankfully, and I do think it's because of these conversations.
Yeah.
That now, I mean, you've introduced a 4-day weekend for the chefs in the restaurant.
Yeah, like the restaurant, Garden Room Restaurant. Yes, I'm going to plug the Garden Room Restaurant here, lads. Right. But anyway, it's a 7-day week operation, breakfast, lunch and dinner. So it actually, it's conducive to the shift patterns work that way. So the guys work 4 days, three long days, one short day, 3 days off. Right. And
geez, that's great. There's not too many in Ireland doing a 4-day week.
No, they're doing 39-hour weeks. Yeah. Right. So that's how it works. And it's worked fantastically. But it's, you know, to do that, right, it takes... you need a few more people than you probably had before.
To grow the headcount.
You need to grow the headcount. But your actual payroll doesn't grow.
Yeah.
Right? It probably is...
Look at hours rather than...
Because you're not paying any time and a half, any double times.
Sunday premiums and everything
else. All that stuff, right? You know, when you actually sit down and do it, work out the math, it's no more expensive.
Yeah.
But it takes commitment from the management, from the ownership and so on. And there needs to be... And once you make a decision on it, you got to stick with it.
Yeah, but look, whenever you see somewhere like, you know, somebody like Peter McGann, yourself, and a hotel that's been at the icing on the cake since the day it opened, it's no shock to know that you're forward thinkers. You know what I mean? Like, it's not about the today and the tomorrow. It's like, right, what's this business going to look like in 5 years?
Yeah.
What's this business going to look like in 10 years? I mean, really, you got to solidify the future of excellence. And that doesn't come overnight.
No.
You've got to be thinking broadly and with the next 5 years, literally, you know, as a minimum. You know,
but I think Ireland is looked upon differently now as a food destination and you have to give credit to people like, you know, Barbier, Fáilte Ireland, all these people for, you know, you went and you've travelled.
You could, I would, but I would also, I kind of slow to get to the game.
They are, but you know, I mean, like,
now they're there now.
Yeah. Right? But I mean, like, we as a group of chefs have travelled around the world for years, and like Instagram has opened up, like it has. No, it's true, but it's opened up to, you know, like people look back in there and go, "Oh, that's going on in Ireland." Because when I was growing up, the place where I used to go to eat was London. Yeah. I mean, we went to
London.
No, but I mean,
we all went abroad. I mean, between
but people
Asia,
are coming
we were
here.
All abroad,
people,
you know?
People are now coming here to eat.
Yeah.
Where before, and I would agree with you.
Yeah, but the standards here are big because it was probably, you know, Ed's wave of college boys went abroad. I mean, he's 14 years and the creme de la creme in London, you know what I mean? We're around the one age and you went to Australia for 6 or 7 years. I went to America 6 or 7 years. London, But you know, the thing is, though, is, you know, I always say when I went to the States in 99, you had, and there's the turnips, potatoes. There's an unrolling joke here about fucking turnips. But anyway, but you know, you're just looking at your basic Mirepoix stuff on the shelves.
Uh-huh.
You come back then in 2005, I come back in 2005, and there's all sorts of vegetables and fruits and different things on
the
shelves.
When I started in the Merriam back in 98, there was a, you remember who was it somebody, Devlin, was his name? Philip. Used to fly stuff from London into Dublin.
There was a company called
company called Vince Sullivan, and I used to use them in London.
Yeah, yeah, I remember.
Like, they used to bring stuff in from, you know, around
Foygras
and France and so on. And I got, when we opened, it became quite apparent to me very quickly, like finding some of the quality of produce that you needed wasn't available. So you had to find it, you know, and I was bringing it in from London and bringing some stuff in from Paris. But it's one of the biggest changes that's happened over the years, which is fantastic. And to pick up on the point you're making, Garth, right? Ireland as a food tourism destination, to me now, is as good as anywhere you can go in the world, right? If you do a little bit of research, and you can eat in this country as well as you can anywhere, right? And I feel very passionate about this.
Yeah.
The Spaniards redefined their tourist industry 20 years ago on the back of El Bulli and so on and so forth. And you know, they had an amazing food culture anyway, right? But look at what they are now. The Danish have done it with
normal. Yeah.
We're capable of that.
Yeah.
Like, we have so many advantages, you know, and here's the key for me, right? We have a young generation of chefs, right, who I'm in awe of, quite frankly, right? They're doing amazing things all over the country, you know? We get Michelin stars down in Ballydehop.
Do you know,
have you ever been to Ballydehop?
Yeah.
Right, Rob's down. Like, I'm like, wow, that thing's guts, right?
Baltimore as well, yeah.
You know, exactly, right, 2 stars. And so, you know, they're doing amazing things. And really redefining the country's culinary heritage. I think it's amazing.
Yeah.
You know, but I would feel very strongly about Tourism Ireland, because I did a lot of work with Margaret from Good Food Ireland. And Good Food Ireland is like a private organization, right? But she came to me 15 years ago, and she articulated what I was thinking, right? How Ireland was already on the move when it came to food and really beginning to grow and prosper. And I've done loads of work with her down through the years because I feel passionately about it.
Yeah.
And I've gone to the States and I've done this and I've banged the drum and, you know, and I really think we've got...
Well, what still needs to change? Well, what if like...
I
what do we need to do more of?
Oh, Jesus, don't get me started.
No, but that's what we're here. We're trying to get you started.
All right. Well, I feel very passionately about the lack of awareness from our government. Right, with regards to what hospitality brings to this country. Now, as you know, like, my partner is Gina from Hugo's, right? So, like, she runs a very, very good restaurant, but and is a wonderful advocate for the industry and a campaigner. But, like, I would have an insight into how difficult it is to run a restaurant, right? You know, I'm an employee. I'm an executive chef. I pick up my wages, but I'm not, like, the buck doesn't stop with me, ultimately. Even though it kind of does. But like for Gina, that's her business, right?
Yeah.
She employs 30 people, say whatever, right? The buck stops with her. Through COVID and all the rest of it, with and I'm trying not to swear here now, okay? Because I kind of get very, very annoyed. The government think or have a perception, and I'll say this like in broad sweeping terms, right? That the hospitality industry is kind of people who do things part-time and you do, you know, you get a job and you're in a bar when you're in college and or working a restaurant busing or when you're on your J1 and so on. I don't think there's much perception of it as a career, as a profession, as a serious skill-based, defined
career.
Industry. Career. Thanks, God. And like, it's very frustrating.
Yeah.
You know, like, you know, what they're doing with the VAT rate and they don't care. They don't care, right? Because they've got this ideology about the market, the market, the market. It's going to take care of itself. It'll fix itself. It'll you know, rebalance itself and whatever. They really don't care, right? And I, like, Gina's much more discreet than I am, right? But she'll talk to me about it at home.
But you see the reality. You hear the realities of the difficulty at home. You know what I mean? Like, but I don't know about Australia or don't know about England. And you can educate me after this. But I know. In America, the industry it's kind of looked down upon, okay? Mm-hmm. You know, you wouldn't get the same respect if you turn around and said you're a pilot or a doctor or a lawyer or whatever it may be. I mean, to the point where it's not that it's kind of a lesser career. It's actually properly, you're just a chef or you're... I mean, I lived with guys that I was earning maybe fivefold what they were taking home, but they still would look at me. Boys taking bikes to fucking work and I'm getting into a sports car. Not being funny, but they still looked upon you like you were fucking stupid, right? And my wife Annette, now she's heard this conversation a lot,
yeah,
because it used to really grind my gears. Yeah. But about a month or two before he became Taoiseach, I had lunch with Simon Harris in Longford, and it was ahead of potentially taking the culinary program out of the university, which Athlone has just been given university status. So there's an old barracks, Connolly Barracks, you might or may not know, Ed, in Longford, that has a few government buildings. Since the barracks closed, they're starting to, it's a gorgeous compound. So we were trying to, I was asked to meet him and help the process of getting the culinary program decentralized and moved into Longford from there, which would be brilliant for Longford. But one of the first things I said to him, I says, do you know what would really, really make a big difference to the likes of executive chefs and hoteliers and restaurant owners around Ireland, Minister, would be if you just put a chef on the front of the CAO forms, or you did something where you, whether it's a mechanic or somebody with a hard hat. I said, apprenticeships get frowned upon now. I goes, even the culinary arts has become so much theory-based and degree-based that, and that's brilliant that there's more opportunities in food now for people to go into food science and other things. But I said, we will have a workforce in 20 years, Tim, that can't change a plug. We'll have a workforce that can't fucking do the most basic of thing. And I says, and as for my industry, you know, if we can get rid of that stigma that if you can't do anything else and you're not up to it, you can be a fucking cook or you can be a chef. We got to start making it attractive and start by, like, I pulled up whatever, I'd printed out like a cover of the CAOs. I printed it at my office before I met him. But it was all shirts and ties and this, that, and the other. You know, there was no hard hats. There was no white chef jackets. There was no doctor stuff. You know, it's got to start at secondary school early. It's got to start influencing them before junior cert and beyond.
Or even, well, I certainly wouldn't feel in Ireland that air jobs are frowned upon the way they would have been at one time. I think now if you tell somebody you're a chef, and I'm saying this not just about myself, but the young chefs that I'm around from the competition, they're proud to say they're chefs. And what I think has really changed even more is that, and I think this is what we're getting really right, is that we're proud of the produce that we're coming up with and our producers. Now, I still think that our producers don't get enough supports and they don't get enough help to get their produce onto the bigger main stage. And that's from listening to them.
I just don't think they get it at cabinet level. Right. Because ultimately, right, you know, you need to have a voice around the cabinet table.
Yeah.
Like that, the tourism industry. The Minister for Tourism is Catherine Martin, the Green Girl, but she also has, I think, three, four or
yeah, there's too many posts. Of, yeah,
it's ridiculous. There is not one dedicated.
We should have a minister for food,
or a food and tourism.
Yeah,
tourism.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it's like, but that's how seriously they take it or not. And like, you know,
it's an add-on for sure. Like, there's two or three. There's at least three different things underneath.
The most people. Remit. There's no other sector that employs more people than us.
Yeah,
it's crazy. And like, I get really frustrated because it's such a fragment. We've no lobbying power, right? We know we've got the Hotel Federation, we've got the Restaurant Association, we've got the Vintners Association, and they're all kind of like looking.
And I believe there's no chance that the 9% VAT's going to come back.
Not a hope.
No, there's absolutely, there isn't a hope in hell,
it's
no.
Not a hope. It's done. And like, but the damage, okay, and the margins are like wafer thin. And anyway, you know, but that, to me, that's like, that's people who are making decisions based on numbers and with very little imagination.
How do you see dining in 10 years' time? Exactly 10 years from today, what does the restaurant industry look like in Ireland? Not in a
global scale.
Just say for now, we could chat about the wider world after, but
I think we'd be one of the food destinations of the world. I really do believe that. And I you know, the nature of the restaurants and you know, the specialization of restaurants will continue.
Yeah.
You know, there's no doubt about that. You know, your Michelin star restaurants will probably be tasting menus and so on and so forth, and there'll be your steakhouses and so on. But they'll all be very good at whatever they choose to do. I'd be very optimistic, Gary.
Okay.
Truthfully. I you know, there's a bit of pain ahead over the next year or two and the fallout from the VAT increase.
Is the labor shortage the biggest worry, or is it rent, cost of business, cost of sales?
It's
all of that. Yeah.
I think the biggest challenge is that it's just so multifaceted. It's not It's not just the wages that are gone up. It's the price of produce has gone up. Yeah. It's the price of energy has gone up.
Yeah.
It's the rates have gone up. And when you put all them together, and pardon the pun here, it's the perfect recipe, not for success. It's
and that's why I'm asking the question, you know.
But there's a lot of smart people working catering.
Yeah.
You know, and like, I think the resilience was really shown during COVID. Because
we had no option.
Well, this is it.
You know what I mean? Like, yeah. There was, and it wasn't without a lot of
grunt,
yeah, but a lot of pain,
you know,
and a lot of the decisions that were made, like, good God Almighty, like,
yeah,
well,
in hindsight, a lot of them look really silly.
Oh, but I'd be optimistic. Now, I'm a glass half full guy anyway by nature, okay, but I'd be quite optimistic about the restaurant and the hospitality industry as a whole. But I wish they, at government level, they would recognize what we've got here.
Yeah.
I think we've got something very special, right, that can only add to what we've got in the country.
Well, many times have you met a guest or have you met somebody and they're like, the hospitality here is like, you hear it's the land of a thousand welcomes and everybody is so friendly, but we really...
natural to us.
Exactly. You really take it for granted.
Yeah.
Until you're away and you're in a different part of the world and...
they're grunting at you.
Really rude to you. Or
5 years. And I can tell you just how friendly the patties are.
But it's true.
You know, it's true. It's true.
Yeah.
Tamira, the tradition on the podcast, the last thing we ask you is if your last ever meal, what would it be? And we've had all sorts of answers. So it's like your death row meal.
Ah, yeah.
So what would you be sitting down to if it was the last thing you were ever going to eat?
That's easy.
McCarthy's a cantor back with that accent.
I actually, you know what?
Never once left.
What do you mean? He has a wonderful dub accent.
It's like the
my niece got married in Cork. He's distracting me now. But I have to tell you, right? My niece got married in Cork about 4 weeks ago, right? In Cork City. And the starter was Jack McCarthy's black.
Yeah.
It was so good.
Gorgeous.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Anyway, my main course is lamb, loin of lamb, pea puree. I didn't know you were going to ask me this, but I know this anyway, right? And
I didn't tell you.
Bit of Dijon mustard, soft herb crust. Just some root vegetables, yeah. And gratin potatoes, dauphinot potatoes. My dessert is definitely lemon tart. And what's his
Paul Kelly recipe?
Oh, no. He doesn't know how to make lemon tart. And where is he? He's like,
I'll be sending him. I need that in a soundbite.
Just so you know, over there, Ed, he's the pastry chef at the Marion, and he's been there for many, many years. But anyway,
friend, be very fond of himself.
Oh, Marco's recipe.
I was
going
to say
lemon tart.
Marco Pierre White's lemon tart recipe.
Can't touch it.
You think, could there really be that much lemons in it? It's untouchable.
It's just follow that recipe. You can't go wrong. It's a classic. Just do it right. And
somebody every season on the restaurant makes it. Somebody makes it every season. It's hilarious.
Yeah, sure. It'd be one. I like tart desserts. Yeah. You know, passion fruit, lemon, that kind of way. You know, that's my thing. Wouldn't be a big chocolate guy. Like, but, and then the starter was just a little bit of a cured salmon. You know, ginger cured salmon.
Lovely.
And there you go.
Well, listen, Ed, we know you're very busy, mate, and it really means a lot that you jumped into us. Thanks a million, and you're in decent spirits considering Cork got battered, in the words of Gareth yesterday.
Good friends here.
Thanks,
guys. Thank you very much.
So next up, we have one of our favourite parts of the podcast, one that's going to be here to stay, and it's our messages from you. So over to Ed Chef, what have we got?
Right, lads, and thanks again to everyone who's been sending in their queries to food@goloudnow.com. Hello, Gareth and Gary. Loving the pod. I recently splashed out on a pizza oven, and I'm determined to have perfected my pizzas by the end of the summer. What summer? So some advice, please. When letting pizza dough cold ferment for a few days in the fridge, is it best to put it in there after first letting the dough rise, or should the dough go directly into the fridge after being mixed and then take it out after a few days to rise before baking? Also, at what point should I make it into balls?
Well, you can make it into balls at any time, really, and then put it into the fridge. The only thing that's going to happen is it's not going to go through the rising process. I mean, you can do this thing called the knockback where you can ball it into the size of dough, depending on where you want a 9-inch, 12-inch, or whatever it be. Like, I'm sure everybody has their own weights for their pizza ball. But you can ball it and put it in the fridge. But it's only really going to rise again when it comes out into like a warm environment, okay? But the one thing that it will be doing is it will be eating into itself. It will be fermenting and eating into itself in the fridge. The only thing it doesn't do in the fridge, obviously, is grow or expand, you know? But as for do you do it before making it out, you definitely want to have... You don't want to roll it out flat like before it goes in the fridge. You just want to have it in its... You can either have the mother ball where it just goes in there in one piece, then you bring it all out, let it rise together, and then cut from there. If you do it like that, then you just got to ball it and let it rest and rise a second time anyways, because you gotta do that after you cut them into individual portions. So I would say fridge them in a tray, balled and portioned, and then bring them out to rise.
Fridge them, then ball them. All right. Thank you, Ciarán Rahilly in Wexford, for that pizza inquiry. Now we're on to the next one. We're going up to Fermanagh.
Gareth didn't get that at all yet, that pizza inquiry.
Yeah.
Oh, look, I'll try again. A bit more subtle next time. Moira in Fermanagh. I have more of a kitchen conundrum rather than a cooking one. Okay. Have you any good tips for cleaning and maintaining my baking trays, pots and pans? I can never seem to get this part right. And my mother-in-law recommends sprinkling on a layer of baking soda, then a layer of salt, then spritzing on a layer of vinegar. But I can't even get this right. Any help appreciated, Moira? Wow. Have you ever heard of that before?
Yeah, I've heard of all of those things you can do. Like, and the one thing they would say is put your trays in the oven first to let them get a little bit warm. And yeah, you can rub salt and you can rub lemon juice and you can rub baking powder. Really, what I would say is when it comes to baking and your oven trays, you have to get into the habit of cleaning them every time you use them. And I think if you do that, you're never going to get that really heavily carbonated black stuff that gets onto them. And then, you know, there's chemicals out there that lifts all that stuff off.
Sell it, bang, degreaser is on.
Is that the one?
Rivaled.
Yeah, it comes in a bag. Is that the one that comes in a bag?
There's a couple of ones. Sell it, bang, it's a spray. Sell it, bang, degreaser.
I think the biggest mistake people...
Barry Scott is the man.
The biggest mistake people make is they don't treat them like they treat a plate or anything else. And they try and keep using them and then they just get buried in carbon. And it's very difficult to get them clean if you do that.
Sit it, bang, and what is it? The thing is gone. Anyway,
there you go.
Boyer in Fermanagh, there you go. That's great advice. Now, Louth. Hello, Gary and Gareth. Gary, I spotted a recent post of yours with the most incredible cheese grazing table down at the K Club. Oh, yeah. Oh yes. He's seen very chuffed with that. I honestly stared at it for hours. I have a family event coming up and I'd love to try my own, but needless to say, I wouldn't have nearly the same budget or expertise. What would your advice be on what cheeses, etc. to use? Also, is it true you're supposed to take the cheeses out 30 minutes before serving? David DC in Louth.
Yeah, absolutely. A minimum of 30 minutes. I would say 45 minutes before anybody arrives at the table. You want to have it at room temperature. It's just so
nothing
much
worse
better.
Than a cold piece,
it's the same. It's the same even for the salami. You know, it comes to room temperature and you get that lovely glaze. It won't have that sort of greasy, cold feel coming from the fridge. And listen, pay no heed to the size of one. Like, I did a centerpiece table for 130 people for an event at the K Club during the week. It's amazing how the most simplest of things. I lost count of how many people reached out to me after they saw that, which was lovely, actually. You know what I mean? But it was literally just a bit of imagination and a table. A couple of bowls, get a little bit of tapenade. I have semi-dried tomatoes that I blend with olive oil for a wee dip. You can just buy a jar of that, blend it with a wee hand blender. Breadsticks. And then crackers. Always have a cheddar if you're not. I always say always have a cheddar. Then maybe have a smoked cheese, a smoked gubine or something like that. A blue cheese is absolutely, cashel blue is absolutely beautiful. For people that love cheese, you got to have a blue cheese there. And then a brie or a camembert, like a sort of semi-soft, like, but one that you can still slice. Have it all pre-sliced. Get a nice, decent... little table lay down some parchment or greaseproof paper, and depending on how many is coming, that is a brilliant idea, where you just then completely cover the parchment paper, have a bottle of olive oil, a bottle of vinegar, a little bowl of tapenade with a teaspoon in it, the semi-dried tomatoes, like I said, and then just fill the space with various bits and pieces until it's completely covered in. And again, depending on the amount of people, I might do that at the Keg Club for 20, for 40, for 60, 80, and 100.
Same rules apply.
And same rules apply. Yeah. All that gets bigger is the table. And it's the most lovely thing to do, where people are standing around it. And that day, for about an hour and a half, 130 guests were all around on the terrace,
in the way,
overlooking the 18th hole on the Palmer North course, grazing away, having the chats. Massive success. And I'm glad they saw that and got a bit of inspiration from it. Yeah.
Great stuff, David Deasy, and best of luck with your cheese board table. Thank you all so much again for all your queries. Keep them coming in. food@goloudnow.com.
And this is us wrapping up season 3. We did say, mistakenly so, on last week's episode that we were going to be taking a few weeks break. We might have a 1 week or a 2 week break, but at Gazza Chef and at Gar Mullins on Instagram, the boys have been re-signed again, Ed.
Back in the ring.
Are you going all Eric Ten Hag on us and staying around as well?
As long as I don't go, I suppose, Van Der Beek on it, I think I'll be all right.
Yeah.
We need you to go full Bruno Fernandes for us and keep the show on the road.
A lot of moaning then, yeah.
Yeah, well, I have to say though, Ed.
Oh, here we go.
We absolutely love Ed Chef running the show. Keeps us on our toes. Another great season from you, brother, and thank you very much.
Thank you so much, lads. I cannot wait for the next season.
Yeah.
And as for Spurs, I could take it or leave it.
Yeah. Spurs, the podcast is going to go from strength to strength, and Spurs is going to win the Littlewoods Cup next year. Guaranteed. Stay tuned. We'll be back soon with some new sponsorship news, a few more additions to the pod, the Culinary Conundrums.
Lots more guests. Any guest suggestions might be a good idea. So if anyone has any ideas, let us know. And really, it's we're going to bring this from strength to strength, as Gary says. And we love hearing from you guys. So give us a shout.
Yeah, food@goloudnow.com for anybody that's got any ideas on guests or whatever. My head's going blank. I don't know. And who to get on next, but again, I think people are loving the mixture of chefs and other people in different walks of life coming on board. So yeah, looking forward to another season, and stay tuned.
Dishing It Out with Gary O'Hanlon and Gareth Mullins, a Go Loud original podcast.
Subscribe for free on the Go Loud app and never miss an episode.
Go Loud sounds better with us.